On this special episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, recorded during the New York State Association of ASC Spring Conference at the Gideon Putnam in Saratoga Springs, New York, we interview state association leaders, discuss the conference and the activities of the state association, and interview several speakers from the conference.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 58 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for June 6th, 2019. We recorded live from the New York State Association meeting in Saratoga Springs, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey, who is the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, and he's one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and he's the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including The Survey Guide for ASCs. John also speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics. So it was great to be in Saratoga Springs.
It was a great conference, too. And we have to apologize. We're actually recording the introduction here a week after the conference. So I think when you said that it was recorded live, you might have been a little bit off because we're back in our studio in Rochester, New York now doing the intros to each of the sections. So I did want to point out, too, this is a slightly different episode than we normally have in that the speakers that were recorded were all sponsors of the show. So there's quite a bit of self-promotion, actually, during this, as is fair, since they were all sponsors of the show.
Lots of good information, too, though, I think.
Absolutely.
I was curious about some of them. So.
Right. But we do need to note that neither the New York State Association of ASCs nor the ASC Podcast with John Gailey endorses any particular product or service, and these interviews are presented for your information only. So just take that into consideration when you're listening to them. It's probably a little bit different than what you're used to hearing. Our first interview was with John Van Valkenburg, who is the president of the State Association. He'll talk a little bit about what's going on with the New York State Association and some of the activities in the past year. Let's listen.
This is John Gailey. I'm recording from the New York State Association Spring Conference here in Saratoga Springs, and I'm here with John Van Valkenburg, the president of the New York State Association. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much, John. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So you and I and Jeffrey and Helen have been very much involved in pulling together this conference, and so far it seems like we're getting some really good reviews on everything, all the work that we put into it, and I'm very grateful for all the work that all of our team has put in. But you as the president have really stepped up in the last year and really done a great job in pulling this association together and some of the issues that we've had with the upstate and downstate stuff. So just I want to say publicly that our thanks for all the work that you have done here, and I know that it has been not the easiest task. As one of the former presidents, I assure you, and I know, and I know that pain is not one of these. It's like herding cats, right?
That
famous phrase.
Yeah, thank you very much, John. And I appreciate all the work you did. You've done a tremendous amount of work to help put this together, the programming, the speakers. And as you mentioned, you know, we're not quite done yet. We have a few hours left, but it's going great. A very successful conference. And like you said, it's been a lot of work putting it together, and it's stressful. But when I see it all come together and people enjoy it and get that good feedback, it's very satisfying.
It's worth it.
It really is.
So tell me what's going on with the State Association. You talked a little bit during the meeting yesterday about some of the goals and objectives here. So tell our audience here about what's up with the State Association, and let's also focus on why people should be members of the State Association.
Absolutely. Like I was saying at the meeting yesterday, you know, it's been a busy year. You mentioned, you know, we've had some change over the past year. You know, we've actually changed, you know, our government affairs and regulatory affairs firm, and we have some new projects that we're working on with them with regards to education of legislators and outreach to legislators, also to the Department of Health, and really try and develop chains of communication with individual legislators and also, you know, individuals at the Department of Health and at FPIC, and you know, where we can, we have that chain of communication. You know, they understand what a surgery center is and what we do and what we can offer to the industry and how we can help solve some of the problems in healthcare today. So really our focus for the past year and moving forward for the rest of this year is really on outreach to those people.
Yeah.
Also on, you know, just again, continuing to build the association to try and attract new members,
right.
You know, really get our, get the word out there, that here we are and here's what we can offer and here's why it's important not just to be a part of the association but to come to these meetings and
right.
and learn about what's going on, you know, because I can tell you it's a great experience, particularly these state meetings. You
yeah.
know, we have so much in common as New York State surgery centers that's unique and different, you know, from other areas of the country and other states. So I find it really valuable, and we're really looking to get some of these others, especially the new surgery centers. You know,
yeah.
there's been a lot of new surgery centers over the past couple of years, and I know there's more coming.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of CONs out there that have been approved. So, you know, we're reaching out to those individuals and those facilities and really welcoming them into to join our association and help help make us stronger and more influential.
Right. So it's interesting. A big part of what we've been trying to do is make sure that we capture those new centers before they come in here. But after my session yesterday, I had somebody come up to me and she says, you know, we've been around for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she did not know about one of the regulations we talked about. She mm-hmm. says, you know, I know this has been in place for a long time. We didn't know anything about it. And she didn't know anything about the state association. And this is, so I built one of the first 20 surgery centers. She was one of the other surgery centers that was built back in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And she didn't know about the association. She didn't know about this, which was, it was actually kind of disappointing to me that, you know, that we've kind of not been able to get to everybody.
Yeah. And I agree it is. And that's one thing, you know, I have found over the past year to be a little bit frustrating is, you know, when I do have those conversations, when I come across somebody and they're like, oh, you know, we didn't know about you. And, you know, that's why we're really trying to figure out, you know, it's tough because the state has directories of the surgery centers in the state, but
yeah.
it's names and addresses of surgery
yeah.
centers. You know, we don't know what they do. We don't know who are the key contact people at those places, you know, so really trying to build that database
right.
And to be able to communicate. And I think it's probably very helpful. I know you have a lot of ASCs out there that listen to your podcast. So
right.
thanks for having me on
yeah.
and being able to talk about this a little bit. But
I'm certainly hoping all of our listeners in New York are already members here. But if you're not, this is a great resource. It's not expensive, by the way.
No, not at all. In fact, new members, you know, we've offered over the past year and we'll continue to offer the first year free for new members.
Right.
Just to be able to get those people in the door, have them come to a meeting. We keep the cost of the meetings very low. This meeting this year was just $100
right.
For the first attendee and $75 for each additional from a member facility to come. So that's our focus, you know, because
right.
obviously as surgery centers, you know, we're already burdened with, as you mentioned, all the rules and regulations and everything that we have to follow and all, you know, costs, you
yeah.
know, we're getting pinched, you know, on the revenue side, you know, costs going up, reimbursements going down. And we want to make sure that we make membership in the association valuable, but also cost effective and have it not be, you know, cost thousands of dollars to be a member and thousands of dollars to come to a meeting.
Right.
So that's, again, to new members, you know, the first year's free and it's right now for facility $750 a year to be a member. And you know, I think that's relatively very affordable.
So I made a mistake when I introduced you to just introduce you as the president of the state association, but you are an administrator. You live this this life every day. So tell me,
yeah.
mention your company at least here.
Yeah, first. yeah. That's my paid job.
which yeah, good point. None of us are paid for
yes,
this.
Yes, yeah. It's definitely a labor of love, the work we put into the association, and you know we are, and I'm passionate about it as I know you are, which is
yeah.
why. You know, we do this work without compensation. But to your first point, I'm the executive director of Upstate Orthopedics Ambulatory Surgery Center. We're in East Syracuse, New York. We're a single specialty orthopedics surgery center. And, you know, that's what I do.
To make money.
Yes, that's what I do to make a living in addition to, you know, to really advocating and supporting and really trying to get the surgery centers in New York, you know, to work together and
right.
you know, to really improve our position.
Well, and actually one of the reasons that you came to, shall we say, notoriety in the state association is that you were working with us during that time with the Department of Health when we were trying to get through some changes or some clarifications to the limited life regulations related to how we get charity care. You had spoken quite eloquently a couple times at when we were talking to the legislators and the administrative branch on these things. So so you've been in the thick of it, not just, as a president here, but well before that.
Yeah, we were, our facility was one of the first limited life licensure facilities. So we were, among the first few to have to go up and do the CON to get our permanent life and be challenged, by the department, I think in a lot of ways unfairly, but be challenged as to the value we're providing and the advantages that we create. And like you said, I mean, I was in the thick of it and I dealt with it. And another thing, obviously, that I know we worked on together, that is really where I got more involved in the state association, was workers' comp reimbursement.
Yeah, right.
And when the workers' comp board was going through and considering new reimbursement models, us really trying to get out there and at least talk to them about it and make sure that we're part of the conversation. That's really what we're trying to do. That's our goal right now. Be part of the conversation. That's what we've been working with Capital Health Consulting, who is our new regulatory and government affairs firm. They've been great about it. And those are the types of things we've been talking about. Like, can we get somebody from our industry on the FIPIC?
Right.
On the Public Health and Planning Council? Because I think, we deserve to be there.
Right.
We have a lot to offer, but unfortunately, I think sometimes our issues and concerns aren't necessarily considered.
Right.
But that's what we're trying to change, and really have our voice be heard and again, be part of the conversation because, we really are part of the solution, I think, to a lot of the issues.
I did want to go back to your comment about workers' compensation because whereas we did spend a lot of time with the workers' comp board, they did not take our advice as to which reimbursement mechanism to use. So I don't want to go on record as saying that what they ended up with was something correct. That we recommended.
Yes.
It's not a bad reimbursement, but it's a very complex reimbursement system that is very difficult. It's black box type method.
Yes, it is complex, and that was our kind of argument again. And now, I think we have an opportunity, and one of the goals, it's probably more of a long-term goal than a short-term goal right now for the association, but is to talk to, not just them, but also Medicaid and to talk about their reimbursement methodologies and what some of the, how that complexity, really doesn't have a lot of benefits. It's got a lot more negatives to it and that there's better models out there that exist.
Cheaper models for the surgery centers to implement.
Right. To implement and again, because there's some surgery centers that either, they pay a lot of money in licensing to be able to have access to that black box or they just are kind of going it blind and they build their claims and they wait to see what they get paid. And that's, that's not the way it should be. And that is frustrating. And like I said, there's other models out there. I personally think Medicare's got a great reimbursement model. It does have, some faults when it comes to certain procedures, but.
The problem, of course, with implants.
But it does in 90% of the cases, a fair amount of capturing the costs. And especially with some of the changes that have been made with Medicare in the last year, where they've lowered for device intensive procedures, they've lowered the threshold. That's helped even more. So,
it is a dynamic system. The Medicare system, whereas the Medicaid system hasn't changed since it was implemented here.
Correct. And that's why I think it's time to look at. And I think that's a conversation that we need to have with the Department of Health. And to me, it seems like a no brainer. But that's kind of more in our long-term goals is, look at reimbursement methodologies and look. I mean, I think what they need to understand is, again, we're doing great things. We have a lot to offer. Like I said, we're part of the solution, but we have to make sure that we're reimbursed appropriately for these procedures or we can't do them, which doesn't help save costs. If we can't do them, then obviously we can't help save the system money.
And we got such a great message. Lower cost, higher quality. What's not to love about an amateur surgery center?
Yeah. That's kind of the nice thing about being in this role. And the thing that I enjoy about advocating for surgery centers is it's really easy to do. I don't have to bite my tongue. I don't have to lie.
Right.
When I say that really, high quality, low cost, save the money. I mean, those are all things that are, I find to be very true and
well documented.
So it's an easy, advocating isn't easy, but but it's an easy pitch. You know right. what I mean? To give. It's just, it's getting the right people to listen yeah. is the challenge.
Well said. Thank you so much for your time, John, as always.
You're very welcome. And thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Next, we talk to Jeffrey Flynn. He is the vice president of the association and the program chair. He's talked to us about how the conference came together and about the location. This is Sue Cronkite, and I'm here with Jeffrey Flynn and John Gailey, both members of the program committee. Jeffrey is the vice president of the New York State Association of ASCs, and he's in charge of the vendors and sponsors for this event. And John has been in charge of the agenda and the speakers. Welcome.
Thank you. Jeffrey, welcome. First of all, welcome to our podcast. It's kind of weird because you and I have been working so closely together on this event that I feel like it's kind of weird for me to be interviewed as a part of it. But yes. So you have been largely responsible for the success of bringing all these vendors here. This has been an incredible, just like our fall conference, an incredible opportunity for the vendors to get involved with the surgery center industry in New York State. Can you tell us a little bit about what it took to put everything together here for the spring conference and a little bit of the challenges we had in coming up to Saratoga, because you're also involved in selecting the venue?
Yeah. I think one of the things with vendor participation is really important because they're a major financial backing that the centers are able to come here and that we can provide a lower cost venue for the individual centers to actually come to the conference itself. That being said, the one great thing is the vendors realize that if we can put all the surgery centers together in one spot and they have the ability to talk to them and educate them, they can do their sales pitch at their booth. But at right. the same rate, it's an opportunity for us to walk through the exhibit hall and not even know that certain problems or different things that are number 10 or 11 on our list, that there's a solution for it and that mm-hmm. and we're actually being educated by them. So I think it's kind of a perfect marriage for the vendors to really re-engage with the state organization, especially as we've now expanded our membership tremendously and really gotten together to be kind of a group of colleagues working together, solving problems, as opposed to single entities where we were all in a silo each day. We're just rushing, plugging holes in the wall to make sure that yeah. everything worked in our own centers, but working together so we can start thinking about what the future of ambulatory healthcare is. And coming to events like this and making them affordable to the centers is crucial in doing that, I think.
So one of the challenges that we always have in the State Association is trying to figure out where the best location is for the event. And, we went to Manhattan in the fall because we have a very large contingent of surgery centers in New York City, a lot of new ones out there. But we also want to make sure that we maintain a presence in upstate New York. So we chose Saratoga. So tell me a little bit about the choice and some of the challenges we've had up here.
Well, it's finding the correct venue up here mm-hmm. was a big issue because we first were looking in the Albany area, but at the same rate, if we stretched a little bit north, it still was more of a leeway that trains were still able to be accessible mm-hmm. for here, because that's one of the things is, where upstate everyone drives, very often in the city they don't. They have to get there by train. One of the association years and years ago, as you remember, certainly yeah. had a conference here. And it seemed to work
for a couple years.
A couple yeah. years, yeah. And when we came back up, they had done some renovation. And so we're picking out different spots up here. There's some other venues near here. Unfortunately, those were already booked already. So as we were looking for one. And the one we had last spring in Albany, that actually had been booked already. So yeah. when looking, when was the ideal time? Because one of the things you were actively involved with, too, is making sure that we don't conflict with other organizations we work with. And unfortunately, right. this is the time of year all the conferences are. So we came up with this June date, and I knew yeah. you were a big part of that we would not be competing with other people right. at this time. And that actually helped us from a vendor standpoint, but also to a number of people that won't be going to ASCA because right. it's too expensive to weigh. They really, we have to make it as affordable as possible to come to the New York State Conference.
Right. I think the location is great, and it has been, Saratoga is a beautiful area. So it's been great. This is a beautiful hotel. I mean, mm-hmm. we've had some challenges with the hotel, but it's just yeah. because of the age and various logistical issues here. Mm-hmm. But it's looking good. We have a lot of very heavy turnout from the vendors here. And we're going to have a number of the vendors on the podcast actually to talk a little bit about their products and some of the things that they're bringing to the table. So,
oh, that's great. Because one of the things also in planning, which we've done and we've gotten ahead of ourselves, which the best thing is that we've already set up that our next conference in the fall, because upstate, downstate, so we allow different centers to go, that we're going to be doing it in Tarrytown on November 7th. And that's going to be the day conference, which we have in there. That being said, you know, planning ahead already, that was one of the best things the vendors like, that they actually know when it's going to be. And you, for instance, in planning the program side of the committee, can start looking at things rather than, oh, we only have 2 months out to find somebody. Now we really want to make ourselves more of an organized organization to do that.
So one of the things that we try to do with this conference, with the program, is to try to have different tracks. And I think I've talked to you about in the fall, but at least for this one, we have two tracks that, well, there's three tracks, but in two different days. So we've been doing a clinical track, an administrative track, a financial track, and an infection control track. And that seems to have gone over very well. I mean, in talking to the people that have come in here, I believe that it has at least enhanced our attendance as a result of being able to choose some, you know, different things that might be relative to them or relevant to them.
And as I think, as at your suggestion, the fall being that it's a one-day conference, that we do have to focus on doing three tracks and down there to make sure that we still get the information for everybody.
That's right.
The great thing is coming here is whether you're an administrator, whether you're a nurse, doctor, whether you're the billing manager or something, there's something at this conference each one of you can get something out of and to be able to take back. And we've created this organization. And certainly you've been a very big part of it, along with John and Helen and the rest of the new board, is that, you know, we've now become that the fact is approachable to everybody, that we're actually trying to help new centers. It's so encouraging now that we have new centers calling us, not only to ask about the conference, but when they're on the phone, well, listen, I have another problem. Can I ask you about it? Because, and that's what we're here for. And that's to promote community among the surgery centers, that, you know, we're all colleagues as we grow, especially since ambulatory healthcare is our time for the future.
Well, and that brings me to the next topic, which is really one of the more important goals that you and I have both had for the conference, and that is connecting with the people that are new in the state, because we have a lot of new surgery centers. And as we've said on the podcast a number of times, people don't always understand what they got themselves into. You know, they were sold a bill of goods by, you know, consultants who said, oh, you know, don't worry, it's not a very complicated thing to do here. And then they get into it and they just don't know what they don't know. So you and I have been, you know, working with some of those centers. Talk a little bit about, because you've been especially dealing with some of the newer centers in the city. So have I, but you've really connected in your role down in the city, you know, a little bit with those organizations that are really struggling right now.
A lot of what's happening is, and what it is they thought it was a great idea to do a surgery center, and they do have the heart is into it, but the vision really isn't. And part of the problem is they go, they get a CON, they do it, and then suddenly, oh, well, what do we do now? And then, oh my God, the Department of Health. And the issue is working through the process of the Department of Health, because one of the things is they want to see quality access of care. And they want to make sure it's there. New York is very challenging because a lot of the buildings in New York are not standalone or street-level buildings. We're talking about buildings where you're on the 10th floor, newest surgery center's on the 21st floor. Well, the, you know, the Department of Health is going to have some real concerns that you can evacuate those patients from there. And the challenges that I think in, especially with new centers coming in, is that it's educating people about the process when they're in the CON process. And that's one of the things we want to encourage. As you get the CON approval, that you're joining with us as a state organization at that point, because that we can help you bring forward. I mean, we have hundreds of years of experience among all of us where we learn by the seat of our pants and mistakes we've made ourselves and can help people with the future with that. And especially as there's so many different new centers and applications coming up, we're seeing that it's then they get to it's almost the deer in the headlights when they get to the Department of Health. And I think that frustrates the Department of Health to a great extent where they're, well, don't you know what this is? Or don't you know
why are you here?
And, and so that's where I think the organization can serve as a major bridge in that particular issue. I mean, very often you were doing it alone across the board. As I've often talked about you, is that you are the team and the manager company that comes in when somebody's made a mistake or needs help.
I don't like that role.
As opposed to, like, let's all get towards the beginning of that phrase and let's start them off on the right path.
That's right. And I think, you know, we're the message is getting out there. One of the things that we're working on at the State Association, too, is developing a packet that we'll give to centers that are just starting out. And we do, John will talk about this a little bit more, or Helen, I can't remember who's going to talk about, but the membership offer, where basically if you're a new surgery center, you get free membership until you open. So, I mean, or within that first year.
And that ties us back to the vendors. The vendor support of us has been able to make the organization offer things like that because they have been coming in. And they're excited about now having a certain level of participation and understanding that it's not just conference for conference, that it's over the whole year membership, and their participation is wanted during that year.
Right. And we want some consistency here also. Mm-hmm. And also, we'll try to bring them into the program as much as we can, as long as they can give us some information that's valuable to everybody and not just about their product.
Oh, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I guess in conclusion, I just want to reiterate, as you announced, our next conference will be November 7th.
7th in Tarrytown, New York at the DoubleTree by Hilton.
That's right. And we've already started publicizing on the podcast. It is on the website. We'll be blasting everybody with a lot of information about it, but definitely we want to make sure all of our vendors, obviously sign up, and that, members and potential members and really anybody that's involved in ASC in New York State marks that on their calendar and comes down to visit us. And one thing to remember, by the way, people need to understand from upstate that Tarrytown is not in New York City.
Absolutely.
It's right off the thruway.
Yes. Yeah.
Very easy to get to. So I was talking to somebody yesterday, so I can't go down to the city. I said, Tarrytown is not in the city.
Yes.
So don't worry about it. And for people in New York City, it's very easy to get to.
Yes. So. And there's a train there. So that's
right.
No
right.
I think it's also that, that's our goal, is to make that the most well-attended conference. Yeah. And then we'll be coming back up in this area, and we hope that one breaks the record for that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thanks so much for your time, Jeffrey.
Yeah, thank you.
Next, we spoke to Helen Lowenworth, who is the treasurer of the organization, and she spoke about the conference and some of the finances of the state association and what's going on with membership. Let's listen. This is John Gailey. I'm recording live from the New York State Association meeting in Saratoga, New York. And I'm here with my dear friend, Helen Lowenworth, who serves on the board of the State Association as the treasurer. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, John. Good morning.
Good morning. So tell me what's going on. So you have the nice challenge. I was the former treasurer. Mm-hmm. It was very nice of you to take that on. I really appreciate no longer being the treasurer of the State Association. So you had to deal with the tax returns and things like that. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about what's going on financially for the State Association.
Well, it's been, I think, an interesting good year. A lot of transition. I think that's important. I tell people when we talk about the association that 2018 and 19 are years of transition. A lot of new board members, a lot of new push, new focus that we're trying to redirect the association into being a little bit more proactive and things like that. So, again, it's a small, relatively small organization. We only have about 75 members now.
Which is surprising probably to people, given how big the state of New York is.
Correct.
But there aren't that many surgery centers.
And then we have to remember, right, there's only about 150. And we hear it's going to start growing. Right. The challenge is to get new membership to sign up. All we really want to do is sustain ourselves as an association, have a couple of meetings every year, provide education to the members, and be proactive in with our legislative people. And so that takes a little bit of money, not a lot of money. And our money comes from basically three places: our sponsors, who support the meetings, membership fees, and then nominal charges for the meetings, so that we can put food on the table and have a cup of coffee.
Right. Well, and to that point, the attendance is only $150. I mean,
actually, it was $100. It was $100, and then it was $75 for extra people.
Right.
Yeah, that's why I'm the treasurer.
Yeah,
and then $75 extra for each person from the same association. So it's really not a lot of money.
No, not at all. And there have been years, by the way, when we were growing, we actually didn't charge for coming here. Now we're just doing this nominal charge.
Well, and the reason for that is it's only $100.
Yeah.
And it just sort of helps us, you got to commit to coming.
That's right.
And I think if you take out the credit card and sign up, it sort of confirms you will show up.
I
think it's helped a little.
Yeah, we've had time problems over the years, especially when it was free, where, we had a lot of people that just signed up and it turned out they just don't show up.
Yeah.
And that's very difficult for us.
So, you register, then you buy the plane ticket or the train ticket or make the hotel reservation. And I think that's helped our attendance, at least at the meetings.
Absolutely. So this conference is up here in Saratoga Springs.
Lovely.
Beautiful hotel.
Beautiful.
Old hotel up here, and a beautiful location here in Saratoga Springs National Park.
Beautiful.
We separate our conferences. Mm-hmm. So one is always kind of in an upstate area, and one is, by the way, upstate by
upstater's definition.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. So that's
or
way
or New York. I can't really bring myself to say the word downstate.
Right.
It's just not in my my vocabulary. But yeah, and that was sort of a bone of contention. What should we say in the earlier years of the association? It was always way upstate.
Right.
And you know, the New York people. You know, everybody's got to travel and drive.
Right.
So I think it was. A nice compromise.
Yeah.
We held a big conference in the city last year, which was fun.
Right. And now we're going to be, with your suggestion, we're going to go to
Westchester County, Tarrytown, New York, which
beautiful
is
location.
Lovely, right on the Hudson.
Yeah.
It'll help the New York people, New York City, I should say, people,
right.
the Long Island people who
especially.
Have a real challenge because they've got to go through two bridges and a tunnel and everything else to get anywhere.
Yeah.
And then the people from upstate, I think it'll be a nice change for them.
Well, I was talking to a friend of mine who says, yeah, I've never been to the city. I'm not going to go to that conference. Mm-hmm. I said, don't worry.
No,
Tarrytown
no.
is not the city.
And you've got, you're surrounded by water and,
right.
you know, we have the new bridge and everything up around Tarrytown. So it's
very historic
it
area. Too.
Yes.
I love Tarrytown.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, so that's going to be, what's our date?
November 7th.
Right.
Yeah. And we're trying to make it a one full day conference and try to plan something maybe the evening before as a welcoming networking event because it is a little easier to travel and not have to be somewhere bright and early in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely venue, so,
absolutely.
You know, everybody deserves a night away from home.
So mark your calendars for the night of November
6th. The 6th, and then all day November 7th.
7th, right. Yeah. And it's always a great conference down there, a great agenda that we developed for the city because we're able to get some people, you know, people from Albany and New York tend to be more interested in going to the city than
and
they
we're
are.
We're already working on the
agenda.
Program.
You already?
Correct. We already have one whole program.
Yeah, actually, we're sitting in the room with our next speakers here from KBR who have already apparently come up with one of the program elements. I have to deal with the program and we're always running out of
I don't want to go on and infringe on my friend's time here, but I think one of the benefits of the association and what we're trying to do is reach out to the members and help them with real operational issues that they deal with every single day.
Right.
And if I'm having a problem, I'm sure you're having the same problem.
That's right.
And it's nice to have a resource to go to, and if we can help solve our problems together, and that's what we're here for.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time, Helen.
Thank you.
So let's take a short break and we'll come back and talk to some of the sponsors of the State Association Spring Conference.
John, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies is really growing fast. We've been adding employees steadily over the past 12 months. Can you tell the listeners what's been happening?
So clearly this podcast has been very popular, thanks, of course, to you and me, because of our wonderful work here and our infectious, I don't know if I should be using infectious personalities in a podcast here about infection control and various items, but definitely we're enjoying doing this and certainly the word is getting out about the great things that we're doing at AHS. So recently we added infection prevention consulting to our services and mentoring of infection control preventionists in the organizations, and that's being headed up by Lori Rodericks, who is our newly certified CAIP individual. So she has the Certified Ambulatory Infection Preventionist certification now, and she's always been doing infection control for us, but now she's got this new title. So she can do ongoing infection control consulting, particularly if you don't have a qualified IC person on staff. She can help you in following up on infection control issues. She can do mentoring of infection control staff. And she can do infection control and sterile processing competencies. And we've also enhanced our life safety services by adding Jim Masters to our staff. He is a life safety surveyor, and so he joins Alex Borneman, who is our director of operations, to be able to do various life safety surveys and consulting on life safety issues, as well as probably the most important thing is follow up on life safety citations. That's a very difficult area for many organizations to be able to deal with, you know, what happens when you get a life safety citation, how do you deal with that? So we now have that ability. And of course, our unique retainer-based regulatory services where we help keep you on top of all the ASC regulatory requirements and always make sure that you are survey ready. Next, we spoke to Anita Walsh with Pacira. Anita spoke about reimbursement for non-opioid medications in an ambulatory surgery setting.
John and I are here with Anita Walsh, the Senior Director in Marketing for Pacira Biosciences. She presented today with Dr. Gary Schwartz and Joe Terry, also from Pacira Biosciences. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, hi, Anita. It's great to have you on the podcast here.
Thank you.
You did a session earlier about kind of the experience with non-opioid medications, and we talked a little bit before this recording about the importance of that. Can you just kind of tell our audience about what is happening in the industry? What's driving us to this point where we have to worry about non-opioid options, and then, of course, get into how that can affect us in the ASC setting?
Certainly. So opioids have been a standard of care for post-surgical pain management for a very long time, decades. Pain was considered a fifth vital sign, and as a result, it was managed to an extent to associate use of opioids to control pain. However, obviously, the ramifications have been significant, and so now we have an opioid epidemic. 1 out of 15 surgical patients would go on to persistent use, and so our focus as an organization and committed to how we can contribute to the epidemic is to educate and inform not only providers, but also patients and consumers around the fact that surgery is the unintended gateway for opioid dependence. And so we focused a lot of the discussion around making sure everyone understands that there are options, non-opioid platforms to address post-surgical pain.
Yeah, it does seem like that made it so much worse, although it was well-intended, but making pain that fifth vital sign. I think people's expectations were not managed very well, and people expect to be totally free from pain, which has kind of led us down that road.
Honestly, what also compounded it was that the institution of HCAHPS scores and patient satisfaction. So in the good intent of trying to manage positive patient experience, pain is associated with a patient's experience. Mm-hmm. And so to mitigate a negative rating on a survey for patient experience, manage pain through opioids. Mm-hmm. So that really compounded the initial assumption for approval for oxycodone was around the low risk of dependence. And then you actually then have a system that really rewards people for having a positive experience, which is very tied to pain management.
Yeah, true.
So we know the president this last year has implemented some changes, and his administration, of course, has been very instrumental in trying to identify some solutions, which included some change to the CMS regulations that have really been very advantageous. We talked about that on the podcast, but why don't you talk a little bit about what the encouragement is right now in the industry to try to get organizations such as ASCs to use more non-opioid medications?
So the fact that President Trump issued a public health emergency related to the opioid epidemic was significant. Organizationally, Pacira has been a big player both at the federal, local, and state level. So the outcome of the commission report, the opioid commission report that Governor Christie was part of and led, really talked about two things. One was that there needed to be concerted efforts in finding non-opioid options to manage pain. And the other was to actually unbundle the use of non-opioid analgesia, post-surgical pain management options to motivate and ensure that people could be given those options as opposed to having a financial disincentive to use them.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what we mean by this for many of our audience who is not financially oriented, so I'm the only financial guy here, is that what CMS did in January 1st, 2019 is made reimbursement for non-opioid. They actually created a HCPCS code that is reimbursable, separately reimbursable. So normally in the ASC setting, all Medicare fee for Medicare reimbursement, that fee that you get is for virtually everything and includes all the medications and all the supplies that you use. And what you meant by saying that you're unbundling is they've unbundled one of those medications. And at this point, the only actual product out there that fits this bill, though it will change, but for now it is, of course, Exparel.
Right. So C9290 is specific to Exparel. It's the only non-opioid, long-lasting, post-surgical pain management alternative. That C9290 code was issued at the time that we launched the product back in 2012, and it was reinstated as an allowed payment so they could be separately reimbursed. So it was basically taken out of the package payment process.
Right. So when you are billing an ASC that is billing for a procedure that uses EXPAREL, will be able to on their healthcare claim, on their Medicare claim, and depending upon what private insurance companies allow, perhaps even on those, would be able to separately list the EXPAREL and get reimbursed. In the past, they could list that code, but it would have been bundled with the original procedure and would not have been separately reimbursed.
Correct. So C9290 today, as of today, is paid at 122 per milligram, which is really important. And one of the things we did talk about during the panel discussion was that if you just submit a bill just for the one vial, we have two vials, a 20 ml and a 10 ml, you need to bill at the unit level. So the 20 ml is 266 milligrams. And so for each milligram that you use and document, you get paid $1.22 per milligram. So it actually covers the cost of buying the product.
So I think the real takeaway here is that now we have a financial incentive to be able to use, you know, a non-opioid option. Of course, at this point, it is EXPAREL. And I hope everybody knows about this by now, but, you know, this is a real win-win. You know, a win for the patients because they're able to get a really great non-opioid option out there. A win for the surgery center because they can help deal with the crisis that we now have in this country. And there would be no financial negative. I mean, you're not going to make a ton of money on this, obviously, but at least you're not going to have a negative connotations to the organization as a result of the financial.
And there are other financial benefits, correct? But just the length of stay, patients not, you know, going to the hospital afterwards, not having all those side effects.
That's actually a very good point to make here is that we talk about the financial and the
non-reimbursement.
And also the effect on non-opioid versus opioid. Talk about some of the other advantages of using this type of a drug, you know, to the patient and to the insurance company.
Sure. So obviously when CMS is saying, ultimately, right, they're a policy arm as well. And so they're saying two things. One is that they believe in a non-opioid platform for post-surgical pain. And they're also wanting to make sure that more and more procedures are migrating into the ASC, which obviously is happening for lots of different reasons. And a lot of the drivers are patients. Opioids are associated with opioid-related adverse events. And they actually negate the intent of what ASCs are all about, which is patient efficiency, throughput, making sure that patients can recover properly and be timely discharged. And so if you have an opioid-centric post-surgical pain management platform, you're actually going to negate some of the drivers. And then there's ultimately also patient experience. So while people like to focus on the acquisition cost of the product, there are offsets that are being also attributed to the benefits of the product that offset the actual acquisition costs. And then the long-term impact of a non-opioid alternative, just the ability to prevent people from being exposed to opioids unnecessarily and manage their pain in an effective way. So I think that ultimately is, we're still so rooted as a company in opioid minimization. And some of the things that Dr. Schwartz talked about today was the multimodal protocols and how do you have, there's a place for opioids, but if you can minimize the exposure to opioids and then ultimately have long-lasting pain, that's effectively going to help everybody in the whole system. ASCs are focused on enhancing recovery. Right? So our message is really around ensuring that the experience of recovery and anything that can inhibit a patient from being able to return to achieving their recovery milestones and then getting to their quality of life expectations, and that's a big part of opioid minimization. And if you can manage through pain, pain really reflects a positive experience in your recovery, allow you to achieve whether it's ambulation or any of the other milestones clinically that have been established that opioids can actually negate. So there's a holistic element to our non-opioid platform. It's not just about managing pain.
You were saying earlier when we were chatting that there are patients out there that are declining surgery, that are hesitant to have surgery because they already have some type of an addiction problem. And making that option available to people, you know, really could be a helpful tool and, you know, something that would really look good for your organization, as well as I think people even that are just aware of the opioid epidemic will really, it'll reflect very positively, I think, if you have this option. I think a lot of people, when they leave a procedure and they have all these pills that are left over, and it really reflects badly, and people are really beginning to be upset about that type of thing. So I think the more options that you can offer people, it's really going to increase your numbers and increase satisfaction.
Well, Dr. Schwartz did talk about the fact that there are patients who are, you know, on the road to recovery who still need surgery, but mm-hmm. they're so fearful of having another exposure to opioids. And so they're opting out. And so he talked about medical assistant treatment patients and who have been properly navigated through surgery without having the risk of being exposed again to opioids and still benefiting from the surgery that they absolutely need. Yeah. So I think in terms of the prescriptions, you know, if you only need 5 or 7 actual pills to get you through that window of pain, there's a whole problem on diversion. So unused pills that stay in people's medicine cabinet and then could likely be used to help a friend or a family member who might be experiencing some pain. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, teenagers who have access to medicine cabinets, and then it creates a whole a cascade of activities around the diversion problem. So these are people that are not even in the whole surgery pathway that get exposed and access to opioids.
Yeah. And again, I know you already said that, but the statistic of 1 in 15 surgical patients runs the risk of, you know, becoming addicted. It's huge. You know, it's something that really makes us look at it and take some responsibility and avoid it when we can.
Yeah, it's really about dependence. So, you know, there's in working with other clinicians and, you know, the 1 in 15 is really more about the risk of dependence and prolonged use. And then, you know, there are statistics that we talked about today as well on the panel is 4 out of 5 heroin users started out because they initially got exposed to an opioid prescription. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's just enough data out there that says that we can find ways to prevent this from happening.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Anita. This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking on our podcast.
Thank you.
Next, we talked to Lauren Peterson and Ruth Cochran of KBR. They had some great information on informed consents. John and I are here with Ruth Cochran and Lauren Peterson from Kaufman, Borges, and Ryan, LLP. And welcome.
Thank you.
So KBR, as you're better known, I actually didn't know that those initials stood for anything until you corrected me.
Surprise.
And I work very much with your law firm. I've only met you, you know, like recently, of course, but your partners and I and, you know, are very much involved in a lot of activities together. You are one of the sponsors of the conference up here in Saratoga Springs. So welcome
to our
podcast. So, you know, I think we all in the industry have a love-hate relationship with lawyers. You know, of course, we love you when we're in the middle of a lawsuit, but we really don't ever want to see you, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
We say,
I would agree with that.
Yeah. It really, you know, by the time you're in there, you're defending us for stuff. So right. I think that's kind of the theme of why you're in front of a microphone today. You know, what can we do so that we never see you after we've been sued? And we had a wonderful conversation. We all had a little bit of alcohol last night around the bar, and we had
we should have set up the microphone.
We should have
the
done
podcast
it then.
Area, yeah. And we would have had a talk.
That's right. But, you know, as a podcast and as consultants, you know, we spend a lot of our time really talking about the regulatory side. Mm-hmm. And our clients hire us because they want to pass surveys and they want to make sure that, you know, they don't get in trouble with all the state federal regulations. But one of the things that they also need to remember is they can get sued, you know, and we all know you can get sued for the strangest of reasons. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes our clients, and I'm sure you'll say this too, you win these lawsuits or there's never any fault found against it. But that's not the point.
Right.
You know, in the process, we have to spend a lot of money on lawyers. So one of the things that we've been talking about last night is that we're all kind of passionate about is informed consent.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, from a regulatory standpoint, we know that we have to get a consent from a patient, you know, prior to doing the procedure. And, you know, the regulations are relatively simple. But the way we actually carry them out gets a little complicated. So can you talk a little bit about some of your experiences with informed consent? And please help our listeners stay out of court.
Sure. Well, you know, first and foremost, we're in New York State. So in terms of staying out of court, it's almost a guarantee that you're going to be in court at some point in time. Mm-hmm. And plaintiff's attorneys are becoming more and more savvy with the surgery center arena and realizing these guys are a deep pocket. They're insured. This is extra money that we can potentially have on the table. Let's sue them. And then as we go along through the case, figure out a theory of liability against them.
Right.
Because oftentimes it's really the surgeon who's at fault, and the direct case is at the surgeon, or allegedly at fault,
because
we don't obviously think our doctors ever do anything wrong. But the surgery center gets dragged into this protracted litigation, and in New York State, it can go on for years and years, unfortunately, before we get to a point where we can get the surgery center out for no money or for very little money. But one of the areas that can come up for the surgery centers where there may be some sort of direct liability is the informed consent area. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that a lot of the surgery centers don't understand. You know, when we get assigned a surgery center case, one of the first things every time I can tell you that we hear from the admins and from the nurses over there is, we shouldn't be in this. We're just a facility, which is the last thing you want to hear from your client. And that's a narrative that we have to change. And I think that narrative can change at the informed consent point and make it an event in the process that the patient remembers, you know, move it beyond something that's forms thrown at them at the front desk.
Yeah.
I think some of the surgery centers that I've seen do it best do it in the pre-op area. And the patient is involved, the nurse is involved. It's part of the H&P that's done in the pre-op area. And you need your anesthesiologist and your surgeon involved too, because ultimately informed consent is the physician's responsibility. It's not your nurse's.
Right.
So I think when it's done best, everyone is involved in it. And it comes out, I think, Lauren, you would agree, in depositions.
Oh, absolutely. So we've had multiple cases at this point where we are taking the plaintiff's deposition. We are asking them specifically, they're looking at a form in front of them. Have you ever seen this form?
Yeah.
And sometimes they say no. Because they don't read anything.
There's a lot that they had to fill out at the beginning, and this is a form that was thrust to them with seven other documents when they were registering, right? Mm-hmm.
Right, absolutely. And sometimes they'll look at a form and they'll say, oh, yes, that is my signature, but they don't remember reading the form. They don't remember anything that's on the form. They don't remember having the conversation.
Yeah.
And that's a problem for us.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And I would say it needs to be a conversation.
Right.
And you would hope that your surgeons that are affiliated with your center are having this conversation before the patient ever gets into your doors. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, you feel like they're not, that's a conversation you need to have with your specific doctors.
Right.
I think some of the best surgery center informed consents I've seen are quite generic.
Yeah.
Because what you don't want to do is create a higher standard for yourself.
Right.
It is the physician's responsibility. So, you know, some of the best consents I've seen have said, I certify that I have discussed the risks, procedures, alternatives with my physician prior to coming here today or at another point. I certify that I fully understand the procedure I'm going through, why I'm going through it, what site it's being performed on, that it's going to be under anesthesia. I understand the risks of anesthesia. And you go through that with them again, have your nursing staff do it, bring the physician over, let them ask any questions, and document, document, document.
You do realize that given our listeners probably just took that section that you had, slowed it down, wrote it down verbatim. So we're going to say those exact words. You're going to become famous for those words. Very well said. Last night when we were talking, I tell all kinds of war stories, and I told about a place that I surveyed where, and I remember the two of you winced. It was like, but I was telling about the story about the anesthesia consent was thrust in front of the patient at the registration desk. And then I told you that later on, so I was already suspicious at that point. Later on, I go and I watch the anesthesiologist who, the only reference to consent was, he said, now, do you have any questions? After he had completed the H&P, he did a great H&P. He did everything he needed to do. He actually pulled out a stethoscope too, which is one of our laughs, nowadays that, I don't know how an anesthesiologist cannot pull out a stethoscope and do something with it. But you winced when I said that because you were just thinking right away, what would it be like in court to try to defend that?
Right. And I think anesthesia is a very important one to focus on because the patient doesn't meet anesthesia before they get to the center on the day of surgery.
That's right.
You know, they've met their physician before. It's typically their private physician. It's typically elective surgeries that we deal with a lot in this arena. So the surgeon is someone who's very well known to the patient.
Right.
They've discussed it ad nauseum before you even get to the door of your surgery center. They meet anesthesia on the day. You know, they do a pre-anesthesia questionnaire, hopefully, all things going to plan, the day before.
Right.
But anesthesia doesn't get to sit down and talk to the patient until they're in pre-op.
Right.
So it is important to go into it a little more. I have a case that's currently pending in New York, Staten Island, so Richmond County, where we got some excellent testimony at the deposition because anesthesia took the time to sit with the patient. It was a nervous patient, and anesthesia took the time to talk them through the type of anesthesia we're getting, the risks, the benefits, the alternatives. And I have some great testimony on that, that, you know, anesthesia was on the ball. Yeah. They knew what they were doing. I absolutely knew what was going to happen. And it's good for us because this is a case involving a negative anesthesia outcome.
Right.
So we have some great testimony there that that's going to get rid of the informed consent claim.
And then I told you another story where we observed in the procedure room, the patient doing the anesthesia. I know you're already wincing here.
I know.
When the anesthesiologist did the informed consent while the patient, I mean, the patient was literally on the table in the endoscopy room. The GI doctor was holding the scope. The anesthesiologist, you know, we had a full IV in, and the anesthesiologist was saying, you know, will you sign this consent here? I mean, I don't think you can get any clear. What's the term in legal terms?
Duress.
Duress.
Yeah. Just horrible.
I mean, we laugh about these things, but oh my God, it happens every day.
Right. And you really also have to think about the fact that these people are so nervous going into these procedures. Yeah. And I think we talked about that a little bit yesterday.
Right.
That even just 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes sitting down with somebody can make them even feel better. Right. They'll remember the conversation. Mm-hmm. It can't be these 30-second flyby informed consent discussions.
So, Sue, one of the concerns that you've always had as a nurse is that sometimes I think the physician and the anesthesiologist kind of rely on the nurse a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, like especially if the nurse is going through the consent form. I don't advise this, obviously, but
where she goes through it first and has them sign it.
Right.
And says, well, you can talk to the doctor when you see them.
Right.
But I think that's they're signing that they understand something before they've had a chance to understand it. So it doesn't really seem correct.
Right. And I think that's why it's important that the surgery center consent is more of a certification of a consent already being obtained.
Right.
Because it isn't the nurse's job to obtain consent for a physician. But we do, you know, as a surgery center, have to confirm that the patient knows why they're there and what they're doing. So trying to create a step in the process before getting the patient into the room where the nurse, the anesthesiologist, and the physician are all there with them. And I know it can be heard.
Right.
Because, you know, there are other cases going on. The surgeon may be scrubbed into another case. Anesthesia may be scrubbed into another case. But trying to figure out and set aside that time to confirm the informed consent, because really that's all your nurse is doing is confirming informed consent. It's not their job to obtain it. So just making sure that that's done and that's clear and the way you draft your informed consent paperwork. Because hopefully the physician has a more detailed consent in their own medical record that really does go through known risks, known benefits. You don't have to get every risk in the world, you know, but the main ones need to be in there.
Somebody we had spoken to had suggested even sending some of that information ahead of time so the patient has a chance to take a look at it. I don't know if that's, you know, because then
I think if there's
talk,
detailed information about it, if you're just confirming
it
was
in,
yeah.
Yeah, so then they can't say, well, I didn't see it. Well, it was sent to your house.
Right.
Long ago, but then there's nobody to go over it with them.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's very easy then at a deposition for them to say, oh, I never received that.
Right.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah. I didn't read it. Oh, nobody explained this to me because there's nobody else around to attest to the fact they read it.
And that would be sort of an extra step as opposed to they'd still have to follow through when they get it to the center.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, you have to think and thinking from the lawyer's perspective, there's there's the standard of care and there's custom and practice. And do you want to create a custom and practice that is beyond the standard of care, that is a higher burden than the standard of care? So that's something you need to think about too, because once you start doing it, you have to do it for everyone. And does that become too onerous?
Yeah.
And the way that comes out in depositions, you know, a plaintiff will ask your nurse, ask your anesthesiologist, your physician, what is your custom and practice for obtaining informed consent?
Right. Okay.
In New York State, informed consent does not actually have to be reduced to writing. Now, we tell you to do it because it's much easier to prove than he said, she said, and it's best practice to reduce it to writing. But, you know, it can come up that we have a case where it's not reduced to writing. We have to argue it. So,
and I do know that is the standard in New York. However, the CMS requirement, now I'm going to put the regulatory hat on, the CMS requirement is that it be signed by the patient.
Right.
Remember,
which
is, of course, the opposite of what used to be, whereas the certification always came from the doctor that he had done the informed consent.
So, it's
so for our listeners, before they all go off and start doing something different here, and as you said it, reduce it to writing.
Yeah.
Because it'd be a lot easier to
document.
The doctor, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put you on the spot with another issue, because I didn't even talk about this beforehand. I think you and I had talked about it, Lauren, earlier. That one of the issues that often happens when you're called into a lawsuit is that you call up your insurance company and they assign you to a law firm. So, and you and I talked about, and I love working with your firm, by the way.
Thank you.
Is the ability to choose your law firm. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Because I don't even know what the rules are about that. But you mentioned that you can step in and ask for a specific firm.
Sure, absolutely. So that is a common misconception, something that we have talked about. I've talked about multiple times at this conference,
right,
is that, oh, okay, well, I'm sued in this lawsuit and the insurance company is telling me who is going to be representing me.
Yeah.
That doesn't have to be the case.
Right.
If you have a pre-existing relationship with a law firm, if you've worked with these people, you can tell the insurance company,
right,
hey, I want to work with these people. I want to work with this law firm.
Especially if you know that they're in the ASC space. You know, if you know better perhaps than the insurance company, who's probably better able to deal with that.
Right. Absolutely. And from word of mouth, you have a lot of colleagues in the ASC space as, yeah, well, that have worked with us, worked with other firms. And
right,
that's kind of how it works around here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so don't be shy. You have to remember, service industry, the insurance company wants your money. So
that's right,
they have to keep you happy too. And that's what it all comes back to. So
right,
if you want a firm, tell your broker, tell your claims examiner when the case is assigned.
Thank you so much, Ruth and Lauren. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you for having
us,
John.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And for our last interview at the New York State Association meeting, we spoke to Marta Schultz and Doug Mars with Simplify ASC.
So this is John Gailey here at the Spring New York State Association meeting, and I'm here with Marta Schultz and Doug Mars with Simplify ASC. Welcome to our podcast.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So this is kind of funny because, I spend so much time in these conferences dealing with, educational issues, the program issues, that I literally don't get around to the booth that much, and I apologize about that. So Sue came back from ASCA, and she says, you need to talk to these people from Simplify ASC. And I said, why? I mean, it was nothing against you. It's just like, I get phone calls all the time about things, but I have to listen to Sue, right, because when she comes back and she's interested in a product, because she's as skeptical as I am about things. So this is great to be able to talk to you a little bit about what's going on. And of course, let's make this general too. I mean, as I keep saying to vendors, when you come to the ASC industry, what you need to do is recognize that we need a solution. We need you to solve our problems. And it's great that your product does this, but more importantly is, what is the problem that we're trying to deal with, and how does the type of product that you've created as well as your specific product meet those requirements? So tell us a little bit about Simplify ASC and what you're trying to do.
Well, first of all, we want to thank Sue for being so smart.
Well, thank you. Say that a few. Now we're going to cut that out, and we're going to keep that on its own little loop.
So Simplify ASC, we've been in the business for over 16 years, but we rebranded this year to Simplify ASC because we felt like the name really reflected what we were trying to do, that the ASC market, and that is all we do, is ASC. Mm-hmm. So that is a little bit different. We wanted to make sure that our product was out there helping people get through their work and loving the way they work, mm-hmm, in a quick and expeditious manner, because unfortunately, a lot of products that weren't built for the ASC are too labor intensive. They require a lot of clicks, a lot of work that people don't have time to do and, mm-hmm, don't want to do, don't need to do. And so Simplify really was the brand because that's what we were trying to do. We wanted to simplify the process. So with that, some of the things that we're trying to help people get past, we found that we did a lot, and Doug can speak to this, we did a lot of research with our current clients who were using our chart product, okay, and asked questions like, what's painful about your process? If you could change one thing, what would it be? How would you make this work better for you? And we found that reporting was a huge issue. They have to report for Sparks in New York State.
Okay,
they have,
yeah,
to report for federal CMS measures. They, mm-hmm, have to report to their board. They have to report to their physicians. They have to report some places in counties. And so that was a big pain point that we wanted to address and drive. And, mm-hmm, so we have a business intelligence tool built into our practice management system, which is almost unheard of. And,
okay,
so I came from the clinical side of things. Mm-hmm. And when I worked with our development team and they asked me, well, what do you want to report on? My answer was anything by anything by anything. That was what they did. they laughed at that too. And I, but the reason was I can't predict what will be requested tomorrow.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Yeah. And so I didn't want to be hamstrung and mm-hmm. say, oh, you know, this is a great report. Here's your canned report for X, Y, or Z. And so our business intelligence tool really allows you to select anything by anything and filter by anything and add another filter by anything. And okay. so we hit it. We did that. And so it's been very fun for me to be able to, my focus has been quality and risk management, mm-hmm. to be able to marry that clinical data with the financial data so that I now can say an infection or a callback actually costs my facility X amount. Or okay. I can prevent, you know, if I look at this process and I decrease my turnaround time in the OR mm-hmm. or I decrease my late starts, I save X amount of money.
Okay, and so really good reports.
And really you could, good.
A way to gear your QI studies or any kind Absolutely. Of thing like that.
Right. We were working with a group the other day, and she said, well, I spent 3 hours of my weekend working on this report because I needed it by physician, and I was trying to marry multiple reports.
Yeah.
And while she was talking, we literally were hitting a few things, and she said, you just did in 5 clicks what took me 3 hours this weekend.
Yeah.
And that's what we want to do. We want you home in time for dinner. We mm-hmm. want you to love working at your ASC again. Mm-hmm. And you don't love it when you're there till, you know, 8, 9 o'clock working on a report for the next day.
I'm a little technically challenged. So for me, I think I mostly saw the chart part of it when mm-hmm. I was at the conference. But it just looked very user-friendly.
Right.
I don't remember the names of the people who were at the booth, but they were saying right. that you just kind of give them your forms and they can customize them. Or if you right. want something like, I kind of like our forms, but
right.
I think we need to change this up, that they can help right. you with that. It just that looks so much easier than most of the things that I see where I'm trying to search around and I can't necessarily right. find what tab. I go through this tab to get to that tab. So Simplify right. is a perfect name for right. that. So.
Exactly. Well, and we, you know, one of our things is we want, and I'm passionate about, and you know, don't give me the soapbox because I'll be on it for hours, about good patient quality care. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody comes to work wanting to do that. Mm-hmm. But I had this happen in a doctor's office. I told them I took vitamin B. It mm-hmm. literally took them 7 minutes to find vitamin B in their med list. No. 7 minutes. I timed it, you know, because that's what I do. But after 7 minutes, you know, they finally find vitamin B. I thought, this is ridiculous. And so, you know, our charts, we take the paper forms that people have used, or, you know, if they're coming from a different EMR, we take what they like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and then we help them tweak it. And yeah. My title is Vice President of Quality. You know, so one of the things that we do is we go through your forms and say, that might be a little risky for you.
Okay.
Or you might, you know, normothermia is a new measure. You want to mm-hmm. make sure that you hit normothermia. So let's make sure you have that PacuTemp with a time so that we can hit that not and get that report and not mm-hmm. make you struggle, you know, with chart review later. But our mm-hmm. chart, because we mimic what people are already doing, mm-hmm. our implementation is almost nil. You know, we come in and we teach you to use a tablet so that you're using a stylus to click where you've used a pen for years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not mm-hmm. scary.
Yeah. I know that feeling. Yeah. Like, oh gosh, I just hit the wrong button. Where am I?
Right.
So yeah.
Yeah.
I think knowing the ASC space too, as you right. said, medical records, anything coming into it, they're kind of going from hospital-based.
Right.
or office-based or something. And you know, there's that whole learning curve.
Right.
And also just knowing the regulations, like you said, if you're going, you probably should add this or that, that can be so helpful to people that are just, they may know this stuff, right. but they're just, like John had said earlier, you're just overwhelmed. You need somebody to help you out with that stuff.
Right, right. We consider our role, you know, we'd say that we have a platform, but mm-hmm. our role, both with our support, our implementation, and with even, you know, hiring me for quality, is that we believe we act as a consultant to you, mm-hmm. that we're a partner. It shouldn't just be, oh, you're installed, see you later.
Yeah.
yeah. And yeah. so, you know, we partner with people. And our software support people, we have 24/7 American-based support. And, you know, even though most ASCs aren't 24/7, you know, mm-hmm. but, you know, some of them, yeah,
questions can be though.
Right.
We know from our company, it could be right. when that question comes up, it could be anytime.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, with now 23-hour stays hitting, yeah. you know, is we're seeing total hips, you know, total knees, cardiology procedures coming in, you're mm-hmm. going to see, you can't have support end at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
You need
yeah.
that. And, our support is phenomenal. People love them. We actually bring them. I think you might have met some of them at Ask if we had, mm-hmm. you know, who's Sam? Okay. Yeah. People come up and hug our support people. Yeah, that's... I had not seen that in the business before. You know, we're,
it's not a usual customer service reaction.
No, they're like, oh, he saved me so really much time.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, we don't think it should take you longer to get a support call than a procedure. Yeah. You know, and if you're doing...
It's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah. And if your eye, you know, eye procedures go very fast, mm-hmm. you know, they need to move fast. They don't need to be hunting for a field. They don't need to be waiting, you know, for a call if they have a support issue. Unfortunately, most of our support issues are things like, hey, I'd like to tweak that form. Maybe add this. It's not downtime or things like that. It's, I think I could do this a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how can you help me do that a little better?
Yeah, getting right? that feedback. So what I also liked about it is that there were different sign-ins and different views that people could have. So if you want to make it simple, that process of, okay, you're in this role, you can see this screen.
Right.
And I believe it was just a different sign-in that people could see different things. So they've got the registration, the medical record, and then you said you can do some searches. How does this all come together? What are all the different areas that you cover?
In my head, I'm going down through our menus so that I don't lose anything. In our administration module, when we come in and we set up, everything's user based. Mm-hmm. So, and I like to say user based because a lot of people base on licensure. And we don't do that. We go by case, you know, pay as you grow. So as opposed to so many licenses, but it's user-based. So depending on your role will depend on what you see, you know, in the menu that drops down. And so if you are somebody that's registration, then you're going to see the patient wizard, you know, come up so that you can get their financial information, et cetera. One of the things that we put in that I absolutely love, we went back to our clients and said, if you... we're looking at your schedule and you wanted to know certain things about a patient before, you know, from the time they're scheduled till the time that their procedures end, what would you want to know?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody had a different answer. Everybody had a different answer. And so instead of saying, well, here's the six icons that you can put on, we customize that. You can select as many things as you need and, you know, put the icon that you choose with it. So if it makes sense to you to put a piece of candy by the diabetic icon, you have that, wheelchair, et cetera. But so then from registration, we have scheduling, registration, billing, claims, quality module, which is, don't get me started there, I'll never leave, the quality module where you can build any forms that you need to track quality. So I was in your session yesterday writing down, oh, I need that. I'm going to build that in there, you know, quality module. And then, of course, the reporting, which is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I hit a lot of them. Yes. I'm not sure I hit everything.
That's okay.
Yeah. You know, I think the big thing is that, you know, we are a single platform. We are enterprise based. And as more and more ASCs are teaming up to find that they, you know, they get better buying power, you know, they get, you know, with their inventory management is another one that I forgot, supplies, you know, preference cards, when they're trying to find those economies of scale. And maybe they don't want all of the same things across their ASCs, but they want some of that. Because we built on an enterprise based architecture, we have that ability to give that. And depending on your role, when you were mentioning the roles, you have the ability to say, this person works across several of these facilities, and they are going to be doing reports, maybe for peer review or maybe for, you know, for board reports. They have access to both, you know, locations, facilities, multiple locations. The folks that only work in one facility, they only see that facility. They don't get that drop down of which location. So that enterprise architecture is pretty new to the industry. And I think it's going to become more and more important as time goes on in the ASC world.
So one of the things that so many of our clients are dealing with, so many of our listeners, I'm sure too, are dealing with is just dealing with the transition, you know, going to a full EMR system. Some of these more complex systems are very difficult and, you know, not getting the specifics about your product, but this transition period, be able to, you know, identify products. And there's a lot of them out there that help you during that time that are not so super expensive. And so invasive in your organization that it provides you the ability to slowly transform into it. What I found is that it's difficult for them to go through that because a lot of them don't know, you know, even Web 2.0.
Right.
What Web 2.0 is.
Right.
And
to try to identify that path forward and to take it slowly so that you don't disrupt the older nurses. I'm not looking. I just looked at Sue when I said that.
He looked right
over. Yeah, now I'm in trouble. you know, those that are not quite as computer savvy as the younger ones. Well, by the way, actually, some of our problems are with our younger people because they expect different types of technology. They would rather not use a computer. They want to text. And I think they want to text the information into the medical record at this point.
Right.
So, you know, what's great is, you know, products such as yours and, you know, the other ones out there that are kind of filling that niche, right? There to be able to, you know, find that path forward without jumping right into the water with these full-blown systems.
Right.
And who knows, as I'm sure you've been talking, unfortunately I had to step away, but as I'm sure you've been talking about, the we're all transforming. I mean, we're building from the bottom up as opposed to the top down. A lot of those systems out there, you know, they were transitioned from, you know, hospitals, and they said, let's dummy it down into the ASC.
Right.
Your product, and a lot of the competitors out there are doing that very thing right now. They're building things right from scratch, which is the right way to do it in our industry. So thank you so much for the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. So I left just as you were saying that you only are in the ASC space. Thank you for that. Because, you know, the number of organizations that I've worked with who I've been consulting with, some of these really large companies that say, oh, ASCs are out there.
Right.
Let me jump into that thing. And by the way, is their budget in the seven figures or eight figures? Right. Yeah, what do you mean? Yeah, well, we started $1 million.
Right, yeah.
What surgery center do you think is going to spend $1 million?
Right.
You know, kudos to your organization for, you know, supporting this industry on behalf of this industry to be really dedicated to it. I really give you credit for that.
Well, thank you. Even our billing goes that way. We went away from the licensure model. Which, you know, came from the hospitals.
Yeah.
You know, you need X number of licenses. So, you know, we bill by case. So we call it pay as you grow.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a month, you know, because everybody has a really busy month and then you have that slow month, you shouldn't be hit with that same
especially
price.
In upstate New York, you know, where all of our people head south, where the snowbirds head south for the winter.
Yeah, but in Florida, it's the opposite. Right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
So we're hitting there. So yes, we love the ASC market. And, you know, I think it's a special person that works in that because you have the efficiency, but you still want that quality of care. And we just want to make sure that they retain those two things and love what they're doing.
Absolutely.
Like we do.
Thank you so much, Margaret and Doug. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Well, that's it for the special episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Thank you for joining us. And please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues. And do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.